flocca dei lampioni di questa città. E chiamami che tempo, e chiamami che ora, e chiamami che il cielo è vino tinto nell'aurora. E chiamami che qui la vita è un'ala di farfalla, e chiamami che finalmente riesco a stare a galla. Mi chiamano Gipon, lungo i muri e i diavoli dipinti sui metrò, lungo e lungo Senna e i suoi fantasmi di vinile, che hanno la fettina sporca e l'animo gentile. Nei quartieri neri che si muovono ondulanti, tra stregoni, fattucchiere, parrucchiere, questuanti, c'è Zazie che sogna le Soleil du Senegal e dice a parte la polisi si lavi se ne fa male.
Listening to CITR 101.9, and you were listening to Give 'Em the Boot with Linda B, and now you're listening to a different Linda B, which is me, and my show Bezneric Rhyme, which for those of you who have heard the show before, the way that it works is that every week, it's a poetry show, every week I take a poem by a local poet, and then the poet and I do the thing in the poem. So if it is, for example, a poem about donuts, and you have many poems about donuts, we might visit donut shops around Vancouver and get counter people to read your poems. This was what happened on episode 2, which I did a few weeks ago. So today I have, as my visiting poet, I have Zach Wells. Zach Wells is currently the reviews editor for Canadian Notes and Queries, and his first book came out a couple years ago with Insomniac. It's called Unsettled, and those poems are mostly poems about his work experiences doing sort of cargo stuff with airplanes up north. And I will just get straight to the interview, and you'll hear what this, you know, particular poem was about. And yeah, I'll be back with you in a few minutes. Thanks for listening.
I feel we've reached a point in our relationship, listeners, where I need to tell you something. It's the kind of thing that's hard to confess, but because I trust you and I know that you won't judge me, here goes. I have have bed bugs. At least I have some kind of insect living in my mattress, which I can't see, but I can feel the effects of. Namely, I've been waking up with itchy bites on my arms and on my neck. Some of you in this situation might have called in the exterminator. Myself, I called in poet Zach Wells.
This is the exterminator's song to the silverfish. Oh, my primitive slithers of silver, fine slivers of shined steel struck by sunlight and scattered, schools of herring-skinned swimmers. Pardon me that I come singing with traps, gases, and powders. Oh, my ascetic lapisma, glue-chewing bookbreakers, pardon my service to these quivering, wretched flesh masses who retch and shiver and spin from your scaled, bristle-tailed beauty. Pardon my demon and sign-off genocides, Argentinas. I am forged from weak flesh, and your every gray death clinks a fresh minted coin in my pocket.
You can see why I called Zach. Although his poem is about silverfish rather than invisible, unnameable mattress insects, and although he admits to having no actual first-hand experience of bug extermination, I knew he would be a willing ally in my attempts to fill my home with toxic fumes. The other voice you will occasionally hear during this episode is Ben Hart, a poet who was on the show a few weeks ago talking about donuts. Ben volunteered to help hold the microphone while Zach and I were busy with the garbage bags and the tape. Here's me outlining the plan. Okay, I've got a lot of criticism for my plans as regards how I'm going to deal with the bug problem. What I have is this dust thing. Ant and roach insect dust. Ants, bed bugs, cockroaches, crickets, earwigs, fleas, silverfish, sow bugs, and more. So I'm not sure what exactly is in the mattress, but it seems to be like something fairly invisible. So my plan, and I'm open for criticism. I thought what I would do is unzip the mattress cover and take the futon out of it. I just sort of thought I should have done it before, but I was a little worried that when I unzipped it, maybe there would be things running around. Although I don't think so. And then to spray dust all over it, and then cut up some garbage bags and duct tape them all around it so that they sort of suffocate the bugs and keep them in, and then they choke on fumes and the eggs don't just hatch. So this is my plan. Yays and nays?
Hey, sounds as good as anything. I washed the cover in like hot water too, because it's probably stuck. Because there's bugs in the mattress, there's bugs in the cover.
Okay, well perhaps I'm gonna start by taking off the cover and throwing it in the bathtub and ignoring it until a little bit later. I did also manage to ask Zach Wells a few questions about his poem. My first question is about diction. In a lot of your other work poems, you employ a much grittier, sort of a more tactile kind of diction, a lower, more conversational tone. This poem takes a much more self-consciously poetic slant, and I'm wondering if you think of extermination as being, in a sense, non-physical.
For me, diction in a poem is very much an extension of the subject matter, and I mean, this poem started pretty much with the word silverfish and a story someone told me about silverfish in a shower in a dirty YMCA. The poems of my book, Unsettled, are about working in the north loading airplanes. A rough kind of diction was appropriate to that. The diction was drawn in many ways from the speech of myself and my coworkers. The silverfish in that sense is the same because I'm taking diction that's appropriate to the subject and trying to build around it. I did some research and found all these cool technical terms like lapisma, which is part of the Latin nomenclature.
I was wondering if you could maybe lead me through some of the stuff you're doing with sound. The first stanza, there's a transition from a sort of muddied S sound, the slither and slivers. I don't know if your grade three teacher told you this, but when I was in grade school, one of the things that, you know, when they try to get you interested in language, they said, have you ever noticed how so many words that start with SL are words that have negative connotations? I don't think they said negative connotations when we were in grade three. But, you know, like slushy, sludgy, slump,
slutty,
all that kind of stuff. So I noticed that you were using that to begin, and I feel like in that first stanza, there's an interesting transition in the S sounds. There's sort of the really repulsive feeling transition. from slither to silver to sliver, which really feels terrible on your tongue. Like, it just reminds you of, like, a really creepy, crawly sensation, right? And then you move into harder S consonants with S pairings, like struck and steel and scattered. And then you move to the herring skin swimmers and that SW, that very smooth. It's a really beautiful, to me, that image at the end of that stanza, it's a really warm sound in some ways. Like, herring, to me, it evoked sort of English breakfast time, as well as herringbone for wool, right, which just made that leap from creepy crawly creature to, you know, creature that we use for clean things, like unclean to clean. And I'm wondering if you can just lead me through how you've tipped the scales back and forth in these stanzas between repulsive sounds and sounds that bring you out of repulsion.
The sounds in the word silverfish, with the double S and the double I sound, and the fact that it is kind of a ready-made metaphor already, because it's neither silver technically nor a fish. It kind of led me in the direction the poem went in, with all of those S and I sounds and that kind of thing. And it was as much about bouncing those sounds around as anything. Where the stresses fall and the sounds of things are very important, especially for this poem, but in a lot of the things I write. What I kind of wanted to do in the poem was sort of problematize the automatic disgust that people have for things like silverfish. Because there is something, especially if you look at them really close-up photographs of them, there is something kind of strangely beautiful about them, kind of admirable almost. They can go for a year without eating and still survive.
It's impressive.
Which is why, you know, I called them ascetic.
Okay, that was maybe the one word that I wasn't...
Yeah,
I was,
they're like hunger artists.
Because I was connecting it to Bookbreaker. I guess they're ascetic in that they spend time with the books. That makes
much
more
sense.
Yeah,
but when they do eat, they'll get into books and eat the glue out of the spine.
The
so I found them interesting for that in their literary deconstructionist role.
We were ready to proceed with the plan. From here on in, you'll hear a lot of zipping, taping, and the melodic spritzing sound of Zach Wells trying to get the nozzle on the can of anti-bug dust to work properly. I got plastic gloves just to make it look like I'm a lot more hygienic than I am. So I don't see anything too nasty.
No, there's nothing readily visible when you make it out here.
What do you see?
It's just a little spot, but I don't know if it's just the coloration in the coffee. I think it's just fluff for the cover, actually.
I noticed those two on the inside.
Are there any safety instructions on this?
Yeah, read the directions.
This is like the found poem in itself. The green earth ant and roach insect dust is designed to take advantage of mineral deposits of diatoms, which have been found useful in reducing crawling insect pest populations in and around the private home or apartment. The patented manufacturing process of this product contains two food-grade additives. Food grade. When applied directly, crawling insects are usually killed within 48 hours. Okay, so what are we supposed to do here?
I think we basically just take the cap off and start spritzing it. It's up to here with powder, and it doesn't spritz super easily. You know?
I think this is the way to go.
While we're busy spraying toxic dust in the hopes of getting rid of these creatures, perhaps you'd like to hear how Zach Wells characterizes the relationship between the exterminator and his bugs.
The exterminator, who knows these critters better than anyone else because he's always in contact with them, he finds something in them to admire. There's something kind of arbitrary about the animals that we turn into, like, positive talismans and the ones
right.
that are untouchables.
And this sort of feeling that, you know, silverfish aren't actually disease carriers.
No, they're
actually
quite harmless. They're like anything else that crawls around in the dark and the wet and scatters as soon as the light goes on. It tends to freak people out. It's part of the unknown. People don't want to know about the dust mites crawling in their skin and that sort of thing either.
In terms of disgust and where to place that disgust, there's a certain interplay between the word skin, the word flesh, and sort of metal imagery here. Mm. It seems to me like skin in herring skinned swimmers is sort of ascribed to, they don't actually get the word skin. Scale, called, but yeah. They don't get the word scaly, and I feel like those are somehow different. Something can be scaly, and yeah. That's sort of a revolting thing, but to be scaled doesn't have quite that. I think because it seems yeah. It feels a little more static, the word. And humans get the word flesh, which we have much more negative associations with. And then the insects also get all this sort of metal imagery where they're silver, right, and they're addressed as Argentinas, which I thought was great. And then at the end their deaths have this clinking sound like a coin. And I'm wondering if you can talk about how those things work together.
Part of making the silverfish more beautiful was making the people more ugly. When you think about people as wretched flesh masses, it just sort of resituates our assumptions and perspectives on things.
In terms of form, one of the things that I wondered, I guess because it takes the form of a song and it has this troubadour feeling to it. The exterminator figure is a bit of an itinerant, kind of goes from house to house, and he gets there and he does this thing for coins, right? It's a bit of a sing for your supper kind of experience.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you were drawing on troubadour song-based in terms of stanza organization.
The troubadour forms tended to be very intricate kind of iterations. Things like ballads, you know, the villanelle was a troubadour form and that sort of thing. They're drawn to these kind of intricate structures. That's a really interesting observation, one that hadn't occurred to me actually. But certainly that's part of my knowledge base. I probably was drawing on that in a sort of subconscious way. The intricacy of the assonance and alliteration in the poem aesthetics.
Well, I guess I just felt like the exterminator occupies such a sort of half-cased position, because he says, you know, pardon me, pardon my service to these quivering flesh masses, which sort of implies that he's not part of that group, you know. And then one thing, this was where...
But then he implicates himself in the end.
He does.
You know, he is also weak flesh.
But this was where I felt like the poem had one of those... I mean, I agree when you start out too logical about it and you say, well, I'm going to do this and the turn is going to come here and it's going to be about this and it's going to finish up with this sing-dance routine.
Yeah, again,
it gets a little bit...
exercise.
It can be dead, right? Yeah. And I felt like one thing that a little internal sort of contradiction that kept it alive for me was that he uses the word forged about himself, which is a metal imagery thing, right?
And it links semantically with coin in the end, too, with forgeries and false coin. And, it's a kind of a betrayal. The forgers and their ilk got pretty rough treatment in Dante's Inferno. And it represents a betrayal of communication and commerce between people, and in this instance, between creatures. So scary.
Clouds of dust below.
Oh, you got a vacuum.
I would turn the fan on, but I think it would be too hot.
That's probably a bad idea.
How do you know when it's sufficiently covered in dust?
I have no idea.
What do we think? Should we turn it over and do the other side? Oh, maybe we duct tape the rubber to this side now and then flip it over. What do you think? Cutting open, I guess? And like,
cut open one side.
Yeah. Okay.
I've just learned in life that when completely ignorant, be assertive.
I think the bugs can hear you. Yeah, that looks pretty good.
For you listeners out there, 4 large Glad orange garbage bags will cover a thin futon quite nicely.
Do you want to hold one end of this? Totally wrong. Maybe it would come up to that edge. Ow.
Definitely work for you guys at the mall at Christmas time. Clean wrap.
A clean wrap. It's what we were hoping for. But then again, how can you ever make a clean end of someone else's life, even if that someone is a bug living in your mattress? There's a line in Zach's poem where the exterminator talks about his demon and sign-off genocides. Demon and sign-off, as it turns out, are insecticide brands. But the question of genocide, of what constitutes a moral or an immoral killing, isn't so easily solved. In some ways, this sort of apostrophe to a creature that you're going to kill, in some sense, for your livelihood, you can say, you know, that's sort of almost like Inuit, the polar bear, or whatever, that
kind
of thing.
Very much part of the ethos of Native peoples, that respect for that, which, but, you know, they're killing them for good reasons, whereas the exterminator's doing it because it's his job, he's being paid to, because these people are basically have this knee-jerk, repulsed reaction to the to the thing he's going.
See, I guess I felt like that was where he's in this really awkward position where he needs to both affirm and sort of deny his association with the human. And I felt like the metal, the being forged from weak flesh, is like I was once flesh, but through this fire of being this figure of death, right, where I come in and I exterminate things. And even just the word exterminator places that figure so far from human concourse.
Yeah, yeah, you tend to picture someone in a mask and a full bodysuit.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see their face.
Right, they're almost scaled in a
way. Like, almost like a hangman.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking of the hangman.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that was one of the things that I discovered was, you know, I wanted to figure out how an exterminator would go about technically killing these things, and Demon and Sinoff are two. That's why they're capitalized in the poem. You can't get that from the radio, obviously, but Demon and Sinoff is spelled C-Y-N-O-F-F.
It looks so sinister.
Yeah. Yeah. And just orally, it sounds like signing off. See ya, sayonara.
Yeah.
Yeah, the notion of genocide sort of expands the purview of the poem outside of this area of specifically exterminators and specifically silverfish into a question of how we as people in societies relate to enemies generally and how we dehumanize them in order to justify our actions towards them. And I think it's a very appropriate question these days with all of the wars that we're involved in the Middle East and all the wars going on everywhere else. You have to shut down your sympathies in order to do some of the things that are being done, and some of the things that are being done are so completely inhuman because of the shutting down of those sympathies. All the stuff with Abu Ghraib and everything else that's been in the news, war crimes basically, not just the routine killing of war, but this sort of out of this world seeming stuff that goes on and that went on in Vietnam and has gone on in battle since time immemorial. I think there are bigger questions that the poem comes at sideways.
This was something I wondered, especially when I heard the way that you read the poem, in that you give your exterminator a very kind of honest Joe, lackadaisical, oh, you know, don't blame me, I'm sorry, but I gotta kill you. And he's got, you know, I mean, it's a funny poem, like you read it and it's a comical image, right? I feel like we have a lot of sort of comical associations around the idea of extermination, I guess, because we're uncomfortable with it. And I wondered, while I was reading it, you know, the way he says, pardon me for this, pardon my services. And I wondered how much you expect the reader to pardon him.
I don't think he's ultimately pardonable. It's kind of special pleading. I just gotta do this, so, you know. And it goes back to things like Nuremberg. I was just doing my job, you know, I was doing what I was told. And at some point, you have to take responsibility for what you've done, no matter what reason you're doing it for. You know, you have perpetrated these actions, or you haven't done something where you could have prevented a situation.
Do you feel guilty about the bugs we've exterminated in my mattress?
No, I don't. I'm a carnivore, and I wear leather. Unless you're going to be a Jane or something and avoid stepping on insects and any intentional killing of anything, you have to accept the fact that in this life we will kill many, many things, and not all of it's unjustified. It's part of being an animal. There's a lot of separation in our mythology, people and beasts, and I've never really been particularly convinced by any of that. If you're living in a place and your mattress is infested and you get bit, you either throw the mattress out or you kill the bugs. there's a certain pragmatism that's required to live on this planet.
Finally, we were standing in my apartment, looking down at a neat fluorescent orange package of mattress taped and garbage bagged up. We were pragmatists. We had done what we needed to do.
Do you think it needs another one?
It wouldn't hurt. I think we need to very gently turn it over. Get some powder on the other side.
So we're going this way?
Yeah.
So I don't hear any, like, little screams coming from his eyes.
All right, let's see that. That's gotta be enough.
Okay. I'm feeling very optimistic about this whole thing.
Yeah. Let's tape it and then put something on top and tape that on.
Okay. What do we think, people? How do we feel about our...
I think it's a real insect death trap.
That's nice. That's effective. You guys did a lovely job. Come over to my house, do some painting, maybe.
Yikes. That was The Winks with Guitar Swing, and I'm just coming up to the end of my show. Sorry, we're having some microphone problems today, a little feedback happening. Before I leave, I just thought I would let you know that the Vancouver International Writers Festival is coming up. That's March 21st, 22nd, and 23rd, and it's taking place at Waterfront Performance Works Arts Club, a few venues on Granville Island, and they're having a whole bunch of great Canadian authors are going to be there. Alice Munro is actually making an appearance, which is fairly rare for her, so I think that's actually sold out, but you can wait outside and see if you can get a glimpse of her if you want to. And so you've been listening to Besneric Rhyme, and today's segment was with poet Zach Wells. You can find his book Unsettled, which came out with Insomniac Press. And next up is Reel to Reel, which is CITR's music show. You're listening to CITR 101.9. And I'm going to leave you with a song. And I will see you next week. Thanks for listening.
Hey! Bon, bah, ok, là. Approchez-vous un petit peu, là. Je vous trouve loin. Ah, ouais. Êtes-vous dedans, là, pour un autre cette corée, là? Parce qu'on est que nous autres, les petits gars du groupe Gatineau, qui vont venir nous pousser une belle petite surlite, là.
La soirée canadienne, je pars tout ce qu'on est partant pour faire, partant à l'ancienne. C'était traditionnel avec une touche additionnelle. Quand je rappe ça qu'une paire de pince large, puis je me sens fané quand je suis là. Je me suis pas dit que papa dit quand même bien. Est-ce que me veiller dans la tête avec sa nécessité de faire temps? On va crisser des bûches d'abois, est-ce qu'on dit ça la nuque? Sortir de l'accordéon, t'en s'attends tout de suite. Joe, allez, on est bas. Je vous vois, drette là, y'a pas ta perdre. Ça sombre bras dessous, mais si mon nez bien sous, mais si mes consorts disent, c'est ça la denesse, t'es dessous. Je vois toute la paroisse, va moi, vous n'y a pas caisse. Vous levez sur vos chaises, y'a comment ça presse. Que pas net, c'est québécois, bah c'est sous sa caisse. Oh, qui fait chaud, ouais, c'est dac comme dans une fournaise. Dans cette corée, jamais je croirai, c'est pas ta forêt. Il est mieux pas rester personne à la place des forêts. Mais vous corée, c'est pas ta doyer, c'est pas ta broyer. Je vois toute l'assistance, ça va débrouiller. Dans cette corée, jamais je croirai, c'est pas ta forêt. Il est mieux pas rester personne à la place des forêts. Hey, sur que ta visite, hein, faut qu'on en profite. Rapport se rit pas souvent quand ça déboule la mythe. Je veux toute la parade, t'es face à drive, elle m'ache pite.
Ok, mon
participe à bac, qui participe. La masse, ça marche, ça avance en tasse. Que personne jase pendant que les joints se passent. Bibo sort des passes, mais si tu veux pas que ça brasse, t'es mieux une petite tasse. Tu veux savoir qu'est-ce que je sais que ma grand-mère. Et qui vit pas, je veux tourner, t'as ceux qui en veulent.
T'as sauvé un de ces trois et qui est du chant.
Tu vois dans mon live, dans ton coq rond. Tu viens d'un village, des beaux enfants. Reste la gêne droit. Crescent de la crête, c'est gâte, c'est ce qu'il y a pour faire sur ta cabane, c'est du planche au plafond. Dans cette corée, jamais je crois, c'est pas ta forêt, mieux pas rester personne à la place des forêts. Puis vous courez, c'est pas ta noyer, c'est pas ta
Hi everyone, welcome to Reel to Reel at the Movies. Robert Waldman reporting back in action. Lots of new movies to talk about today. Reminding everybody that you are listening to CITR FM 101.9. We're going to begin by a family movie. Parents often think and say that there aren't enough movies for kids that the whole families can go to. Well, I've got a good movie for you. It's called Bridge to Terabithia. And actually, it's based on